Thank you, Pasa Calexico. Welcome back to the podcast. Like always, before we begin, I want to thank my friends here at Calexico Brewing Company for allowing me to record today's episode here. I really, really appreciate you allowing me to, you know, use your space and come here and have a beer and enjoy a conversation with my guest today. My guest today is a returning guest. I think it's your third time here. The first time we do it in person. I think the first time we did it was like in the middle of the pandemic. And then we did it once things started opening again. But my guest today is Assembly Member Eduardo Garcia. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for the invitation. You're absolutely right. This is the third time that we get to chat with you, and hopefully not the last. We did have some interesting conversations during the pandemic in terms of what was going on statewide, of course, in Imperial County, giving a real-time update then. And then we circled back sometime at that kind of tail end of the thick of things, and really exciting to see how Imperial County, from a COVID perspective, today we have the highest vaccination rate in the state of California. And it was a matter of this county, its people, working closely with the folks on the other side of the border, developing what I call a community-based strategy on how to reach folks here in the area to, one, get tested, two, get the vaccine. And today, again, we celebrate what is the highest vaccination rate in the state of California. Of course, we don't forget how impactful COVID was to our families, our friends, our loved ones that may not be here anymore as a result of COVID, but certainly a lot of lessons learned for us. And I heard the governor say something not too long ago, and I think this is really a way that I think it describes what happened here in Imperial County and how people came together to try to keep themselves safe. And it's the governor says something like, it's an African proverb that he says, if you want to go fast, go alone, right, to try to do things. But if you want to go far, go together. Mm-hmm. And the community of Imperial County came together, and the community-based organizations, county leadership, city leadership, all of the public health experts. Mindful there were differences of opinions, but nevertheless, we're here. Yeah. And again, I want to just celebrate what is, I think, seen throughout the state as a major success in the highest vaccination rate here in Imperial County.
And you know, speaking about our community and our rally, it's really different. You know, you can't really compare it to, I mean, many other small towns or valleys, like, you know, Coachella has, you know, it's an agricultural county as well. But Fresno, you talk all these, you know, up north. But, you know, here it's more, you know, people, even though they don't live here, they're kind of migrant. Yeah. They cross the border. And, you know, it's a community that's only, you know, even though they're migrants, you know, they cross the border, and, you know, it's really different than in other areas.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If you look at the kind of demographics from a ethnicity standpoint, from a socioeconomic standpoint, you can make a lot of correlations to different parts of the state. You mentioned a few not far from here, the eastern Riverside County, Coachella Valley. You can go up to the Central Valley and see communities that have very similar demographics. But the uniqueness of Imperial Valley is the border and the bicultural components that exist, national components that exist. And when I say bicultural, right, it's the uniqueness of the Mexicali border with the recent migration of Haitians to going back 100 plus years of the migration and the presence of Chinese folks from Canton, right? And so there's a lot of uniqueness that exists on our border here in Imperial County that makes us that much more special. But also, something for us to look at, that when we're trying to do things in this area, there isn't a playbook that you can look at and say, oh, well, they did it like this over there, so that's how we should kind of take the approach here. That, absolutely not. It's a unique place. And I'm actually very proud, say my parents are from Mexicali, and that, the family is spread out here in Imperial County. And that much of my young childhood and even a young adult life, you know, was spent and now has been spent, you know, the last 8 years of representing this area has been very, very self-gratifying for me to meet new people, to reconnect with old folks. And then, of course, coming out here, being here representing this area is, you know, something that I've really enjoyed.
And, you know, going back to what you mentioned about, you know, you're on your eighth year of your, you know, your appointment as a Assembly member. But before that, you know, because I was doing a little bit of research, you know, these last couple of days, kind of trying to, you know, learn a little bit about yourself. I read that, you know, you were, what is it, 27 when you got elected mayor for Coachella?
Yeah. I had darker hair, a smaller waist. We were 27 years old when we jumped into the political arena. And it was as a kind of passion that I picked up early on in my teenage years, where I got to work at City Hall in Coachella. My job was to videotape city council meetings, and I became interested in the political arena, the work, the public service side of it. And when I took off to college, you know, I had that in the back of my mind. When I graduated from the university, I started working as an educator in the local school district, and very quickly became acclimated with the politicals of the community. And there was an election 2 years after, you know, graduating from college. And immediately it was like, hey, we need young people. We need educated people that have energy, passion to serve. And we jumped in, and we didn't even test the temperature in the water, man. We just head first. And you know, thinking back, are there things that I would do different? Most definitely. But I have no regrets. I have no regrets from the perspective of I've been able to now be in public service for almost two decades, and serving majority of time in local government as the elected mayor of the city, and now in the state legislature, carrying a vision that started at the local level. And, you know, I spent the day today talking to local elected leaders, celebrating victories as it relates to investments into building and renovating new parks. That was what we did when we were mayor, along with other things. But those are the things that were fun. Those are the things that I got to see faces of gratitude and appreciation, because those are the things that will last for a long time. I joke with my little girl, not far from where we live, there's a park there. And I tell her, Ella, I said, I helped build that park. And although she'll be like, yeah, whatever, you know, that'll be there for a long time. And maybe down the road, she'll remember that I told her that story when we were driving by, and maybe appreciate it a little differently. But nonetheless, 27 years old, I got into public service, and here we are a few years later.
You know, here in Calexico, we have a really young city council member. We have another young person running for city council. When you look at, you know, when you were, you know, in local office to what they're facing, what they're fighting for now, you know, some of the I don't know if it's the social issues or that they're trying to advocate for. Back when you were a young mayor of Coachella, was it something that was, you know, on the top of your list? Yeah. Or?
Well, I'll tell you, what were the issues that were important? When I was running for city council, people wanted better roads. People wanted the city to be cleaner, beautified. They wanted to have diverse businesses come to town for them to shop at. And they wanted to be able to enjoy, you know, green spaces, parks, and recreation, like they got to see in other communities adjacent to Coachella. So that was the agenda. But at the core of that, there was also an anxiety that existed, because people wanted to see new leadership. People wanted to see younger leadership. They wanted to also give an opportunity to those who had gone away, got an education, and had come back, and now were young professionals. They were willing to give those folks an opportunity at that time, and they did. And the city council in the first 2 to 4 years of my service completely transformed to a young city council. I mean, I was 27 when I got elected, but 2 years later, two young men got elected who were 23, right? And again, had an education, were young professionals in their own respect. And that was the beginning of what I call a transformation of Coachella politics, and the direction, the vision, and the mission. And look, I can say it myself, but I think others can say it better. You know, there have been a lot of good things that have come out of that transformation. And you know, what's ironic is that today there is a push in the city of Coachella, as there is across the state of California, for young people to enter into the space of public policy. And so there is a challenge of some of the folks that have been there for a long time. And it's going to be interesting to see how the community responds. Now, bringing it back to Calexico, you know, one thing I think that's important is that we recognize and appreciate young people wanting to step into the realm of public policy and politics. But it's also important that the mission and the vision be clear in terms of the roles and responsibilities of a city council member. I know that today we're kind of pressed to take positions on social issues that perhaps are not within the city council jurisdiction, taking a position on the issue of a woman's right to choose, or a position on LGBTQ issues, right, are important. People want to know where you stand on those issues. Those issues probably are not on the agenda for purposes of improving your roads or your parks, or for that matter, economic development, right? But the issue of equity is, right? The issue, and so those are things that I think I see young people talking about, which is important, and we support those conversations to take place. But I think in our local communities, people want to want good roads to drive on. They want good businesses to shop at so that their money stays here locally. They want good schools, and so good partnerships between school leaders, city leaders is critical. They want a safe community, right? Making sure that our police and fire departments have the resources that they need to be able to respond to emergencies. And that requires economic development, right? To generate the resources to make those investments. But I commend the young people that are stepping into the city council races, the school board races, the IID races. It's good to see that people are interested in serving. And I think that's the most exciting part of that.
Right now, are you in recess or are you in session?
No, we're in recess, using this time to gather, you know, information, check in with people, let them know what we worked on the last 9 months in the legislative session. We had a great year when it comes to bills being signed by the governor. We had a great year as it relates to budgetary investments coming to the district. As I mentioned earlier, we were in El Centro presenting a check for $5.7 million that comes from Prop 68, something that we authored for purposes of getting money for parks. That's the same initiative that provided $220 million to Salt and Sea improvements, which are under construction right now off of 86 and Pole Drive. If you're driving past Westmoreland, you can actually see, you know, a $200 million project that's building habitat, air quality mitigation for the residents of Imperial County and, of course, the entire region. So, yeah, we are just making the rounds, letting people know what we did last or this past session, and also getting ideas on what we should be working on in January if the voters allow us to continue to serve them.
You know, going back to the Salt and Sea, I just read this article. Well, yeah, it was because I actually read two articles in the last couple of days. One was by NPR, and the other one was by the LA Times. The one I read today by the LA Times spoke about for a long time, one of the plans to kind of bring some more water to the Salt and Sea was bringing in some water from the Sea Cortez. They were advised to kind of like not even do that or think about that.
Yeah, there were about 12 projects that were submitted to the Natural Resources Agency. The University of Santa Cruz was selected to do some analytics, you know, feasibility, both economic, environmental, practicality, right? And I think on paper and in concept, it seems like it would be a no-brainer and an easy thing to accomplish. Build pipes, it's downhill, and bring water from the various bodies of water that are not far of proximity, whether it be the Pacific Ocean or, for that matter, Sea of Cortez. But from a pragmatic standpoint, you know, these PhDs in these areas of economics and environmental, you know, review arenas and engineers are saying that may not be the best direction, aside from it costing maybe somewhere in the range of $80 to $100 billion. That may not be the most effective way of going about this at this moment. And they're asking us to be more realistic on the circumstances that we're dealing with today and what's in our reach to be able to have a salt and sea that might be smaller, but that will have functions both for air quality mitigation, habitat restoration, and the potential for having some recreational components that could really make it of value for the region, for the county, and for the people who live in and around the sea, right? Seeing some type of life that would be back for them to enjoy, right? As opposed to dealing with what today is seen as a very large environmental problem that we have. But I think that there are some good things happening. And, you know, outlining the $220 million project, the state is sitting on an additional $350 million that we were able to secure for purposes of additional projects that are part of the Salt and Sea Management 10-year plan. The idea that lithium recovery will generate hundreds of millions of dollars has been set up in a way where that money will be assessed by the state and it will all come back to Imperial County, 100%. 100% of it, 80% will go to the county, 30 of that 80% will go to the communities in the North End to be able to make, you know, quality of life type investments. And then the other 20%, right, of the 80, or of the 100%, I should say, that I'm referring to, is going to go into Salt and Sea projects, like the ones that we can visibly see on Poe Drive and 86 Expressway.
Yeah, and it's crazy because, you know, we always hear about, all this money gets allocated for Salt and Sea, for the New River, but a lot of people get a little frustrated because, you know, the bureaucracy of, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with or, you know, seeing projects fruition. How do you make sure that people understand that, you know, things are going on in the background, but you know, it's... This is government.
Well, I'll say, I mean, we can get on a car right now. We can get on a bus and we can drive down the 86 Expressway and make a right on Pole Drive and go down a dirt road and get to a place where we'll start seeing the multi-million dollar project that's under construction. And you'll also be able to see some of the project that's already been completed. The purpose of that project, if anyone is interested, in the Salt and Sea 10-year management plan, is to cover up dried up areas for two purposes, air quality mitigation and creating habitat for the species that depend on that body of water. Two major components of the 10-year management plan. In that plan, there's also the opportunity to build what they're calling the perimeter lake to be able to attract some economic development and some recreational use of it. So that's underway. And so when people say, nada pasa, no hay nada, no hacen nada, like I can grab you, pull you in the car and take you over there to see that, right? You mentioned another project that is probably on top of minds of a lot of people. The New River, you know, $60 million have been secured for purposes of New River improvements. There's a project that's actually in the engineering phases right now with the city of Calexico and the Department of Water Resources. We are hopeful to see that project start construction very soon. And I think when that happens, a lot of people will be in awe and realize that there have been a lot of people working on this for many, many years. Going back 20 years, my predecessor started some of the work in creating a role and responsibility for the state of California. And I only say that because the reality is that the problem is Mexico's problem. It's the federal government's problem of the United States because it's a binational problem. But because of the leadership of my predecessor, Manuel Perez, and then we got to pick up, you know, the baton where he left it, we've made it a state problem. And the reason why we believe that was important is because it's Californians who live on this side of the border that are being impacted by the poor air and poor water quality that I think a lot of families would tell you that live in and around that area have attributed to their illness and in some cases to their fatality. I've met people in town that have said, my mom, my father got cancer as a result of living right next to that place, right? And I can't say they didn't, right? But the reality is that it's a problem that has been long lasting and we're very proud of the work that's been done there. When I got to the legislature in 2014, one of the first issues that we jumped on and one of the first press conferences we had to announce what we were gonna work on was the issue of the New River. And so we're really proud of the work that's being done. And like I said, $60 million have been secured, and there's engineering taking place right now to actually make the project work in a number of phases for the city of Calexico to manage it.
Yeah, and you know, going back to that, you know, it's
¿Se vale echarse un traguito la
cerveza? Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Go ahead.
Just want to make sure we're good.
Yeah, it's part of the podcast. Talking to politicians and just being involved in the community, you kind of see how, you know, projects, especially projects like that, you know, take a lot of time, take a lot of planning. Yeah. I mean, nobody's going to want to go in that water and work. Like, yeah. There is not an actual plan on as to how they're going to be working on it safely, not only for the people around it, but the people working it in that project. And, you know, planning takes time. So
it does. And it takes money and it takes leadership. And it takes a lot of collaboration. You know, in the work that we do, there's a lot of people who are doers. There's a lot of people who are talkers. And then there's a lot of people who can. And then there's a lot of people that can't work with other people. And that, a lot of times, unfortunately, becomes one of the biggest impediments to getting things done in government. The idea that people work in silos, the idea that people work for taking credit versus the greater good and really seeing the results, the outcomes. And so I can tell you that, you know, in my close to 2 decades in government, we've run into all of that. But here what we see is an amazing opportunity for purposes of improving a public health issue that's been just a bad thing for people. My dad grew up on the other side of the border in La Baja, Orizaba, my mom in Pueblo Nuevos, which is closer to where the New River runs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's an area that when they were kids, they would probably jump into that water, right? Unknowingly, that it was industrial and human discharge, right? And so we know the problem. You know, there's a gentleman who's from Calexico who works in Sacramento as an advocate for farm workers and workforce. He attributes his polio to the New River and having, you know, lived adjacent to that area on the Mexicali side, right? So, I mean, this is personal for a lot of people, and we've kind of personalized it as well, that we want to see this project off the ground and we want to be able to secure additional money and hopefully appeal to the federal government to do their part. The United States federal government hasn't invested in this problem, nor have they invested in the Salton Sea problem. And so we're hopeful that that will change in the next few years as well.
Going back to lithium, it seems like all of a sudden, like, everybody stopped talking about lithium. At the end, I can't remember what happened. How did they decide to tax the extract of it?
Yeah, the assessment is in three tiers. And there was a big debate on whether or not it would be done per ton or if it would be done based on sales receipts. Doing it per ton is a much easier way to track and to be able to assess it, right? Whereas sales receipts, I don't know, a good accountant, a good management team and administrative team could show you numbers that may or may not reflect the actual sales that were taking place. I'm not saying that that's what was going to happen, but for the state of California and its mechanisms of being able to account for lithium coming out of the ground, it was easier to set it up as a per tonnage.
Yeah.
And what we did was three tiers, right? We said, hey, for the first couple of hundreds of tons, you are going to pay this much. For the next tier, this much. And then for the third and final tier, it will be this much, right?
It was going down.
And it will actually increase.
Okay.
It'll increase, allowing the lower costs on the front end to help industry get off the ground, get its feet
to recover
on the ground.
Whatever.
Absolutely, right? And there's also close to $1 billion of incentives that were included in our budget that are focused around the lithium industry to be able to not only recover the lithium, but establish an entire supply chain. We would love to see an entire supply chain established here in Imperial County where you're not just recovering the lithium, but that you're processing it, that you're manufacturing it, and that maybe those large consumers of lithium batteries, whether it be for energy storage or for vehicles or for watches, computers, what have you, will find the uniqueness of this region, its workforce, its proximity to, you know, the ports and to, you know, commerce highways going to Arizona all the way to Florida, the 10, the 8, and see the geographic area as a strategic location to do the entire business. And so that's a strategy that ties into what locals want to do, what the state want to do, and what we've heard many leaders here locally talk about. And we're hopeful that that's where we go with it.
Yeah. And as of right now, do we have any bidders on the work that
you have? You have the geothermal developers that are the lithium kind of industry representatives, where they've set up already contracts with the off takers. You know, there's GM has a contract with one of the developers out there. There are other car manufacturers that are both American and foreign, talking to our industry representatives to look at how they may be a direct source of lithium procurement for their needs. You see the direction that the state of California is going in terms of less dependence on fossil fuel, the idea that vehicles will go to electric vehicles by a certain period of time. That's where the world is going. Mm-hmm. And we have what I think people have discovered, identified as one of the largest deposits of this mineral to be able to recover and to provide what is about 67% of global need, I've heard. So it's exciting to be able to set the policy that reflects what the locals said to us they wanted to see happen. We aligned with the leadership of the county on this one, where they wanted to make sure, like, we didn't sell out the community. And I'm very proud to say that I don't believe we did. I think we set up a structure that will be directly beneficial to Imperial County residents because the lithium belongs to them. Yeah. And they should be the direct beneficiaries of it.
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption, but I want to take this time and thank my sponsors. I want to thank my friends Camilo, Jake, Eric Ortega. I want to thank Eddie Lopez from Roots Creative, Ms. Norma Sierra Galindo, IID Director representing Division 5 and serving the entire Imperial Valley, Will Torres from Valley Sports Network, your Imperial Valley source for sports. I want to thank Sergio's Tacos and Hot Dogs. With 8 years of experience serving the Imperial, San Diego, and Yuma counties with Mexicali-style hot dogs and taquizas, contact Sergio at 760-562-0057 or look for Sergio's Tacos and Hot Dogs on Facebook. I want to thank Eric Reyes from Los Amigos de la Comunidad, empowering communities together. Finally, I want to thank David Gastelum. If you're thinking of buying or selling a home in the Imperial or San Diego counties, make sure you contact David. He's not only a realtor, but an investor with over 20 years of experience, and he'll teach you along the way in one of the most important investments of your life. Contact David at 760-235-9576 or look for David Gastelum on Facebook. All right, guys, well, now back to the show.
And in terms, you know, we talk about, you know, the monetization of the lithium, but when it comes to the environmental, you know, side of it, you know, how is the state looking out to make sure that, you know, the people in the surrounding area is, you know, being taken care of when it comes to environmental stuff?
Yeah, look, every project will stand on its own feet, and they will need to go through an environmental review process. The county will ultimately be the approving or rejecting agency of these projects. There will be a lot of eyes on that process by local community organizations that are looking out for the environment, environmental justice issues. And what we also see and what we've learned throughout this process is that the practice of recovering lithium here versus how lithium is recovered in other parts of the world, it's night and day. We're talking about lithium recovery being a byproduct of geothermal procurement or energy development here, whereas we're not opening up the ground, we're not using, you know, large amounts of water that are not already being used for purposes of generating power through geothermal usage. The geothermal energy is just as valuable and important as the lithium recovery process, because we need the baseload energy to go into the system for purposes of reliability. You know, how many times this last summer, these last couple months, did we ask people to, hey, conserve, yeah, right, energy at these hours of the day, because the system is kind of getting overloaded, not just here, but throughout California. We were very fortunate that we didn't, you know, see any blackouts. This energy that will be produced by the geothermal and provide a byproduct of lithium is a win-win. Mm. But all eyes will be on the process and making sure that we're not impacting the environment more than what we already have seen take place with the salt and sea degradation. And so that's why these resources are critically important to reinvest back into these projects at the salt and sea, and that 30% of the 80 that the county will receive, that they go back to the north end counties to be able to, again, invest in quality of life type projects for the communities of Nylan, Calipatria, Brole, Westmoreland. Mm.
Yeah, because, you know, at the end of the day, we're hopeful that, you know, this will bring more people down here. So we might be building new homes. So we'll obviously need better infrastructure when it comes to, you know, bringing in more people into the county. The other thing that the other big thing that I read on, you know, this article, I was actually, it was funny because last night we were at home and I was reading the article, and then my wife's like, what's NPR? I'm like, oh, it's National Public Radio. So she was trying to see if the article she was reading, it was the same article that I was reading, and she didn't know I was reading it, but she was going to tell me about the article. She was trying to see if it was like a valid source, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, it's NPR. It's a good source. So I just finished reading the article. So it talks about, you know, how the Valley, Imperial Valley, is the one that uses the most water when it comes to, you know, Nevada, Arizona, and, you know, a lot of the, you know, states surrounding us. But, you know, the valid reason is, you know, we feed a lot of people, and not only in the states, but, you know, around the world.
Sure.
And it's obviously going to, in the next couple of years, I mean, even maybe months, is going to be a huge topic when it comes down to, you know, deciding on how are we going to be conserving more water? Where are we going to, you know, take cuts? What's going on?
The fact is that there will be an unsurmountable amount of pressure put on California and our water agencies to conserve more water. The other states that depend on Colorado River, whether it be the upper or lower basin, you know, groups, will really put a lot of pressure on California to do its part and contribute its fair share of conservation. Otherwise, they're going to seek the support of the federal government and them kind of the stick or the carrot, right, type of approach. And we're hopeful that we can put together what will be a comprehensive conservation plan that doesn't impact our agricultural economy and that ultimately can contribute to this, you know, dryness that we're experiencing, this drought that we're experiencing due to a lot of different things, including the climate changing, right? But nonetheless, it's going to be a very, very difficult conversation, I think, that's going to be coming up. There's also a unique opportunity here, and I think the Imperial Irrigation District leadership recognizes it. I think that they're talking about it and they're advocating for this, is that if we're going to do anything drastic here, the federal government needs to step up and mitigate some of the issues that we have out here when it comes to using less water. And yeah, that may mean the impact on the ag economy, but that also means, and I know that they've been talking about this, contributing to resources or contributing resources to the problem at the Salton Sea. Right. So it's a unique opportunity. It's a major challenge, but with a unique opportunity to actually get some positive outcome for some of the most pressing issues that are facing this valley and the people of this valley. And that's the Salton Sea crisis. So overall, they're not going to be easy conversations. I was the former chair of the Water Parks and Wildlife Committee and would get briefs on this matter regularly. I know that our representatives in the governor's office are in D.C. regularly talking to folks about this issue and the impacts. The states, you know, as someone put it to me from the governor's administration, they're going to start ganging up on California. They're going to start ganging up on us in Southern California, and they're going to want us to make some drastic cutbacks when it comes to our water consumption. You know, so we got to be ready.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I guess the tough part for you is, you know, it's basically, you know, the Imperial Valley against kind of the states and the rest of California, because you know everybody else wants a cut of the water as well, you know, San Diego, LA area. So, you know, and obviously, you know, not everybody in the valley has a pool or anything. It's, you know, the water that we're being used, it's going into, you know, agriculture.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I was watching this video where, you know, they did like this graph where like 80% of the water is agriculture. Even if we stop watering our lawns, you know, cut down on our pools, it's...
Yeah, the impact won't be significant, mm-hmm. right? And it's really the large users in the agriculture industry. It's a lot of people talk about at the state level, the amount of water that's used for alfalfa, right? Mm-hmm. For alfalfa, and some people don't see, you know, the big picture and the value of the alfalfa, you know, process and the economic impacts, right, for the region. Nonetheless, you're absolutely right. It's going to be a fight. And right now it's California and the other states, and it could potentially turn into, you know, us down here with our own, you know, colleagues up and down the state of California who are saying you all need to do more down there. Right. But we'll be ready. And I hope that, like I said earlier, you know, together we can go farther. And I hope that we can come up with a strategy where we can be together on this issue and not be mandated, you know, by the federal government on what it is that we need to be doing.
And you know, not to talk about our local farmers, because, you know, they've done an amazing job of already cutting down on underuse. But, yeah, hopefully if they're able to get some kind of help and invest a little bit more in irrigation systems that waste more water, or maybe even, you know, because I know there's a lot of water that wastes, you know, when it's coming down to Colorado, it goes down, you know. Sure. So, you know, yeah, there's a lot of things where we could, you know.
I'll tell you, our farmers in Imperial County have done a really good job in obtaining money from the state to transition their irrigation systems, their electric systems, right, for purposes of energy efficiency and water efficiency. And there's some really good examples. They're called SWEEP programs, and what they are based on, they are part of the climate investment dollars of the state of California, because there's two really main objectives there, aside from reducing, you know, the use of water and also the use of power. We're also reducing emissions, right, at the same time, and that's what those dollars are intended to do. Close to $70 million between here and the Coachella Valley have been dispersed over the last 4 or 5 years of these SWEEP dollars, S-W-E-E-P, and the Local Farm Bureau and the UC Riverside Extension program out here that focuses on ag. They've done an excellent job, and they're continuing to advocate for more farmers, big and small, to take a look at these grants and be able to transition over. So, you know, a little bit at a time, and you get a lot of people, I think we can actually have an impact and ultimately put forward a good conservation strategy and plan for the region, and not have the federal government come and hit us with a stick and tell us what we need to be doing.
Yeah, yeah, because I mean, that's the, you know, the thing that nobody wants, you know, the, you know, let's resolve it in-house and then, you know, go from there. But anything else that you know, from the state that you would like to?
Well, look, I mean, we had, as I mentioned earlier, a very good legislative year. We were able to obtain an additional $30 million that will be shared with the people of San Diego as it relates to the Tijuana River and the New River. Total of $60 million have been secured for the New River project. I mentioned the status of that project with the city of Calexico, their leadership, and the Natural Resources Agency. Excited to see the Salt Sea project moving forward. Talked a little bit about the lithium activities that took place. You know, there was $1.1 billion of a program. It's called the Innovation Grant Program, for purposes of stimulating, you know, what I referred to earlier as a supply chain for lithium and other clean tech industries to come to California. But there's a strong emphasis on the lithium side of things. We get to see $5 million coming to the county for purposes of establishing a specific plan with an EIR out there. And there's also money, close to $1 million of that five going to make sure that there's community outreach and engagement, make sure that the people that are continually, you know, providing input on what their concerns may be out there, what their anxieties may be as it relates to this industry getting off the ground. But nonetheless, as I mentioned, for me, exciting is to see the money roll down and make its way to Imperial County, whether it be for parks, whether it be for paving alleys to improve our quality through the AB 617 program. We've seen some good housing dollars make their way to the region from Calexico to Imperial. Every time I come through an Imperial Avenue, I look to my left where the tiny home project is, and that was a collaboration between the city of El Centro and the community college. There's just so much happening and so much more that can be done working in collaboration with our local leaders, both in the city governments and the special districts that we have out here.
And that was something that I wanted to ask you, you know, the housing crisis. I think, you know, homelessness is something that, you know, we see all across the not only the state, but the country. But, you know, see, you know, L.A. with, you know, they have a huge problem of homelessness. Here, I don't think it's you know, people might see it because our downtown is where, you know, most of our, you know, our population is at. And, you know, they have issues with, you know, being able to, you know, attract customers and stuff like that. What is the state trying to do to, you know, alleviate, especially, you know, help those people that might have some mental health issues or drug issues that, you know, might not want to go into, say there's a homeless shelter, they might not want to go there because there's rules and regulations that they need to follow.
Yeah, you know, the state's investing a lot of money as it relates to housing and housing tied to homelessness. And of course, every community in California is going to be different, and it's going to require a different strategy and a different plan. You're absolutely right. You know, the visibility of homelessness here versus what we would see in a large urban setting is very different, right? But we're seeing it increase. Mm-hmm. And homelessness really comes in different shapes and forms, right? I mean, the project that I made reference to, the tiny homes, were built for homeless students. Right. And you think about, well, homeless students, that's not the same homeless person that we think of that's living underneath the Interstate 8. Right. Mm-hmm. The veteran that may be on the streets or that, you know, that woman, you know, who may have had a mental crisis and just never got back on their feet. So for us, one of the strategies, aside from just building more housing tied to homelessness, is actually increasing the workforce in the mental health arena. There is a large gap, a shortage of mental health service providers to be able to have the ability to do the wraparound services. Putting a homeless person who's got mental health issues in a home is not going to solve the problem. They require the wraparound services, and we have a major shortage. There's a program called California Volunteers that's investing a lot of resources in trying to get people on the track of becoming mental health service providers. Becoming nurses, becoming teachers. And so in this particular case, you know, we have to beef up our workforce in that area and ultimately create those partnerships. And honestly, it isn't just government, but it's with our nonprofit organizations that work in the space of hunger and homelessness, as well as the faith-based organizations, to be able to partner with government, to be able to, again, build these housing developments that will have these resources to provide for folks. You know, one of the alarming issues is the suicide rate amongst veteran women. And certainly, you know, we see a large amount of people that are veterans living on the streets. And that's something that we need to do better by and do more for. But it's going to require us to work within interagencies to do that. So that's just some of the things. There's been historic investments in that area. And our job as the legislator for this region is working with the organizations here locally to make sure we get that money down. Just as we've gotten that money down for projects and parks and other housing projects that are not related to homelessness, we need to make sure that those homelessness dollars make their way here as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, mental health is a huge issue. And you know, there's a huge, you know, need for, you know, mental health workers. And, you know, sometimes it's hard because, you know, being somebody that feels overworked in a job that's, you know, not as hard as, you know, helping people with mental health problems, that you probably take those same the same problem is that that person has, you probably take them home because, you know, it can be contagious. You know, you think of the things that these people are going through, and you're talking to them, and you know, I have friends that work in the mental health, you know, field that, you know, they sometimes, like, they'll start talking about it and they cry because it's really hard to talk to.
Yeah, no, it's something that we have to be very mindful of, right? Again, the image that we have of someone that's homeless. The reality is that there is not this one kind of, circumstance or individual profile. And, you know, I was flying down from Sacramento recently, and there was a correction officer who works in the prisons in the Palo Verde community. And we started talking. We ironically were going to the same community. He lived, never met the guy, and he lived not far from where I live in Coachella. And we hit it off. We started talking, and he was talking about what happens in the prison and his job, right? And the need for us to provide, you know, on-site programs and services, not just for the inmates, but for the correction officers. Yeah. The mental health, you know, kind of status of many of the correction officers, given what they see and deal with on a regular basis, aside from, you know, the idea of hoping that they're able to clock out and go home that day, given the environment that they work in. And that applies to our law enforcement folks. That applies to the professionals in the mental health arena, which is, again, I mentioned, there is a huge shortage of mental health professionals. And that's why, you know, the governor, and through his initiatives and investments and the legislature, are pushing the agenda to try to get more professionals in that field to try to help us curtail this major problem that we're having. And look, during the pandemic, the mental health issues became more prevalent amongst children, mm-hmm. amongst adults. Shoot, I mean, being locked in, locked up, was not really pleasant, mm-hmm. right? And so they created some level of anxiety and frustration. But it's real, and it impacts all of us in all capacities of professional life.
I mean, even for, you know, for younger kids, you know, it was a huge hit, you know, the mental health problem. And, you know, also parents that aren't, you know ready to deal with, you know, kids dealing with. But let's talk about November. You know, you're up for re-election, and I want to talk about the district as mm-hmm. a whole, because, you know, you represent Coachella and Imperial Valley, but there's also, like, you know, smaller, you know, populations out in, you know, out here east, and you know, that, you know, in your 8 years of, you know, being in assembly member, you've gotten to know, mm-hmm. you know these little nicks and corners that represent, you know, the district.
So our district, the one that we are now running to be reelected in, has changed a mm-hmm. bit. Very fortunate that Imperial County is still in the district, and the Winter Haven areas, and we'll continue to work on the issues that we talked about earlier that are priority to the people of Imperial County. We continue to go in this new district to the Palo Verde communities. We wrap into the Eastern Riverside areas of communities of Indio, Coachella, Indio Hills, Bermuda Dunes. We no longer are representing the communities of Cathedral City and Desert Hot Springs, if elected, mm-hmm. in this new seat. But our district does go up to areas in Western Riverside County. We go up into the mountains, if people are familiar with the Hemet, San Jacinto areas, Anza. Those areas are now in the district. And we've spent a little bit of time out there meeting folks this election. And then we got a nice little surprise at the last minute of the redistricting, and the district now, the new district that we're talking about, goes all the way to Needles, which is in San Bernardino County. Mm-hmm. And so we now, if elected, get to represent three different counties, San Bernardino, Riverside, and Imperial, three very different geographic areas, very different socio and political thought processes that exist in these areas, meaning, you know, people's political inclinations. And so, you know, we've got some work to do to really build trust and confidence in the voters of these new areas. I got to reintroduce myself and let them know who I am, what I've worked on, both as mayor and as an assembly member, and what I hope to be able to accomplish for them in these new areas of the district. So it's changed a bit, making us work as hard as we would regardless. But nevertheless, it's going to be an interesting district to represent, given the diverse interests that exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something that I've asked, you know, some of the candidates running for our local office, mm-hmm. like IAD or city council, is like, how do you make sure that, you know, you're representing everybody equally? You know, you've been doing it now for 8 years. You know, you've been reelected twice, right?
Four times. Oh, okay. 4 times. Every 2 years.
It's every 2 years.
Yeah, that's right.
So you've been reelected 4 times. You know, what do you think, you know, has made you successful so far about, yeah. you know, representing, you know, everybody in some way or form equally?
Well, I'll tell you, right? I'm present. Showing up matters. Obviously, you can't be everywhere at all times. And you can't be everything to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you're nothing to anyone, right?
Yeah.
Right? You can't be for everything. And so I recognize that sometimes we're going to have to take a position that is to the disliking of someone or someone's. But as long as, you know, it's a position that's grounded on values and principles and I can explain it, I can look at you in the eyes and say, and this is why I voted yes or this is why I voted no, then I think I'm okay, right, in terms of where I need to be with myself and the politics as well as the area that we're representing. But I'll tell you, you know, for me, what's been the most important thing, and, you know, it may sound funny and silly, but I'm the same guy that was elected 8 years ago in terms of our persona, our approach to policymaking and politics. I'm the same person when it comes to being approachable, accessible. And, you know, my buddies will say that they've known me doing this work for a long time. I've kept it real, right? We've kept it real, right? I can sit down here with you and drink a beer and not, you know, pretend to be someone that I'm not and really prioritize the work that we do. Like, we work hard. Someone asked me earlier, do you get tired? I said, absolutely. I said, but I know what I signed up for, and I have a passion for this work. And I also get a lot of gratitude, as I said earlier, to see the end results. The end results being $40, $50 million coming to the region for parks, affordable housing, you know, for the Salton Sea, for the new river projects, for better air quality. You know, and so that thing motivates me, that excites me, and I hope it does others as well, and that it motivates them to allow us to keep serving them in the California legislature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the opportunity to serve perhaps another 4 years, and I intend on doing that and doing it to the best of our ability and having no regrets, making sure that we do everything that we can during our time in the legislature for the people that send us up there.
Yeah, for sure. We're almost at an hour, and you know, it's getting late. I don't want to take more of your time. Anything else that you would like to, you know, talk about, mention that I didn't talk to?
Well, look, I think we covered a lot of ground, including, you know, what's at stake for us in November, and I appreciate you asking that question. I want to be humble and respectful of this time and also of those who are watching us and ask them for their support on November 8th. I would be humbled to receive your support and get reelected to serve you in the California State Assembly another 2 years. For me, it's an honor to be able to just kind of spend some time with you here. Say hello to everyone watching us in Mexicali. I often get the little text message after an interview or some kind of media, you know, activity from the family members in Mexicali. It's like, hey, te miramos en la tele o te escuchamos en el radio. So I know that there's a far reach when it comes to the social media activities in Calexico that go across the border. Shoot, I even got a message when I threw out the first pitch at a Aguilas game and I threw the ball in the dirt. Immediately, I got a text message from a primo that said, hey, what the hell was that all about, man? So nonetheless, just want to say thank you, man, for having us on the show again.
No, thank you for coming. You know, a lot of times when I you know, have guests on, you know, I'll Google their names, and you know, often you'll see, and even on the platforms where I listen to podcasts, you know, I'll see if I Google your name, it'll come up that you're on a podcast, and I'm kind of proud that to say that, you know, you haven't been in a lot of podcasts. This is probably one of the few.
Yeah, yeah, I get invited every so often. You know, we can sometimes we can't. I've enjoyed, you know, talking to you about what's happening in the legislature related to Imperial County. We don't do a lot of podcasts. I think we did a podcast while we were in Glasgow, Scotland for the climate conference. Mm-hmm. I think I've done a podcast with someone from the Capitol, but not a whole lot of podcasts. We do a lot of interviews. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of panels. I mean, I've gotten the opportunity to speak on panels in Paris, France on climate change. I mentioned Glasgow. We did a press conference out there about environmental justice issues. But anytime you want us on the show, man, we'd be more than happy to come back. We can talk about, you know, what my favorite tacos are, or what my favorite teams are. But I appreciate the time that you shared with us today.
And I appreciate, you know, your staff reaching out. Like I always try to make time. Like today, I just got off work and, you know, ran over here. But, you know, it's an honor to have you on, you know, talk to you, see what's going on, you know, at the Capitol. And yeah, once again, thank you for being on. And, you know, since it's campaign season, and I want to, if your opponent is listening to this, you know, reach out, and I'm glad to hear you out too as well. I know you represent us, but, you know, I try to be fair and unbiased when it comes to...
It's the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. But once again, thank you for coming down.
Of course.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy your beer. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Salud.
All right, guys. Thank you again for listening or watching, and we'll see you in the next one. Peace.